CBS Live Show on UK Health Radio. My name's Robin Daly, and as well as being the regular host for this show, I'm the founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, that's been helping people with cancer for the best part of two decades to find out about what integrative medicine has to offer them in terms of support in recovering their overall well-being. Every week, I'm fortunate to host experts from the field of integrative medicine for cancer, but every now and then, I get the opportunity to speak to one of my all-time heroes of the field, someone whose mark on the progress of cancer treatment is both indelible and unquestionable in the most positive way. Ralph Moss is in the throes of a relaunch of half a century of analysis and opinion in the form of an impressive new website. I'm speaking to Ralph about this over the internet on the east coast of the US. Ralph, such a pleasure to have you back on the Yes to Life show.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
So today we're here to talk about a major development at the Moss Report, which I think has a lot to do with a significant change that's happened in recent years behind the scenes concerning your team. Do you want to tell us about this?
Well, we are in the midst of making the major change, I would say, to my work and to the Moss Report. This is now coming up on 50 years that I've been involved in the cancer field.
Yes.
And I must say that I have the same or more enthusiasm for this going forward as I did in the past. But we have to keep up with the times. And that means really changing our whole way of relating to the public and to the cancer patient and cancer treating population as a whole. So we started with mimeograph machines, which I'm sure some listeners aren't even aware of what that is.
I'm not sure I know what a mimeograph is really, but anyway.
My first job in life at 14 was running a mimeograph machine for a company in New York. So what I mean is that we handed out pamphlets and leaflets outside of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York when I was still an employee there, a kind of a risky proposition. And then when the web came about, we were among the first health sites that related to that. I went to the first meeting of the web at University of North Carolina in the about 1993, and they couldn't get it to run. They brought in all the so-called health experts and they couldn't make it happen. But in 95, we went online, had our first website. But and then we've had a series of newsletters. Cancer Decisions was one of them. Mm-hmm. And then about 5 years ago, my son Ben and I partnered formally partnered. He had been involved all throughout the, you know, even going back to his childhood with a lot of the events that I was involved in. And Ben brought 25 years of experience as an IT and tech director, mostly for schools, but he really knew and knows his way around the internet like, you know, I'll never understand it or hope to understand it.
Right.
So this was a very, very potent combination, I would say, because I just, you know, kept my nose to the grindstone basically for almost 50 years.
You have.
Reporting on this field. And Ben had developed these amazing skills in terms of the internet. So we started to completely, not just redo the website, but reconceptualize the whole company. And we have been working steadily, mostly he, but I've, you know, with a lot of input from me, in creating this new website, which is really like almost like a new company, the Moss Report in the singular.
Right.
And what it is, it builds on over 1,000 articles. I'm laughing because it's a little hard to believe.
Yeah.
But over 1,000 articles that I've written over the years, mostly about complementary and alternative approaches to cancer, with a good deal of sort of political commentary, political, and not in the large P sense, but in the sense of critiquing the logic of the positions taken by the National Cancer Institute and the American Cancer Society, my former employers at Memorial Sloan Kettering. So that's part of it for people who are interested in the history and politics of this. There will be plenty, and there is plenty at the site for that. But on the other hand, a wealth of information written on the spot about many of the controversial cancer treatments that have come along. And along the side of that, to the side of that, I also was creating the Moss reports, which were specific to particular kinds of cancer.
Yes.
And I think, Robin, you're probably very aware of that.
Yeah.
We were charging a considerable amount of money for those individual reports. In fact, to a great degree, that's how I was able to be a full-time, maybe the only full-time freelance cancer investigative journalist in history. But it kept us afloat for the last 30 years, at least. Now, all that material will be available with a membership in the Moss Report, which is much more reasonably priced, and people will have the ability to see and read all the reports. So if they're only interested in one particular report, then of course they can just relate to that. If they're interested in the whole bigger picture, then we have all that material. And I've gone over it, and updated it as of this year. So I think that, you know, as I've said to Ben many times, I mean, that alone would be a very functional website for millions of people.
Absolutely.
And that's just one part of what we've done. And we've also, Ben mostly created a practitioner map, which we're filling in the blanks. I mean, one of the big things that I did over the past decades was to take trips to visit the clinics that people were interested in. And I once counted it up, and I had made 18 separate trips just to Germany.
Have you?
You know, I like German food.
18 trips, right.
18 separate trips.
Wow. That's amazing.
Airfare, you know, back and forth. And trying to keep our independence of all of this and be able to make a living while doing it was a big challenge. Big part of what I did, big challenge. And then of course things change, people pass away, clinics lose a key practitioner, they add new treatments, or clinics fold, so it's a dynamic situation. And one of the things that I'm really looking forward to is being able to in person renew those connections, because COVID of course put a big dent in our ability to travel, and now we're sort of back to that. I may not be the one going, it may be other members of my family or people that we engage or assign to do that, but there's nothing like seeing for yourself.
Absolutely.
Sometimes one little thing that you'll see can really be very insightful about the actual situation. I'll give you one example,
okay,
Robin, that there was a clinic in Mexico. I won't name it, but they advertised that they gave hyperthermia treatment. Now, hyperthermia treatment in the German context means many, complicated, medically sophisticated equipment, and they're monitoring the temperature in the liver, and they're, it's high-tech application of heat to the cancer patient, usually concurrently with receiving some other treatment. So I was interested and excited to see the hyperthermia equipment that this particular clinic was offering to the patients. It was a $10 heat lamp from Home Depot, crudely nailed to a board.
Right.
That's what you may get. Or you may get the $200,000 hyperthermia equipment in a different clinic. So the name, just because somebody says something doesn't make it true. Yeah. That should be no surprise to your listeners. And also, what are the other lessons from this? I mean, you have to be very careful, be careful shopper when it comes to going for cancer treatments. Not that these people necessarily were fraudulent, but they were doing the best they could with limited resources. But that best they could may not be good enough for you because it's a crisis situation.
Absolutely. It's a huge investment people make to go to these places, just the travel alone and all the accommodation.
Absolutely.
And everything. So to have a scout who's gone there and has spotted the hypothermia has some shortcomings is gold dust, actually. That's so important.
And that's very valuable. That's a very big part of the new site because we're building on that. And I want to emphasize to you, Robin, I mean, I'm been in this a long time. I'm approaching my 80th birthday, and it would be a logical thing to think that perhaps I'm retiring or taking a back seat in. I don't feel that way. I knock on wood. If I had some wood, I'd knock on it, knock on cardboard. But I've been very, very fortunate in that, I'm still healthy. And I'm still excited, which is more to the point, I would say. I mean, it's as much the point as anything else that I have plans for the future. I have ambition.
I want to talk about that later on. Yeah. So, yeah, good.
So
I thought you probably had.
It's a very thriving thing. And having brought my son, my daughter-in-law, some of my grandchildren into this, my grandson Jacob filmed and did the site visiting and edited a film for us 2 years ago, Immunotherapy, The Battle Within. I wrote it and I narrated it, and my son Ben produced it. So it was a three-generation Mossman production, and it won an award, so we're very proud of him and proud of it. And that'll be at the new website also.
Wow, real family firm, eh? Brilliant. Love it. Normally, that's right, all your work could very easily just fizzle out and become obsolete. And I'm really happy to see that that's not happening. So look, not everybody who's listening is going to be aware of your extraordinary legacy. So just to give a bit of context for your latest offering that we're going to look at, I wonder if you give us kind of edited highlights, if you like, of your journey the last 50 years or so, starting from that junior officer that you mentioned the beginning of your career. And, the things that happened that kind of give your opinion the weight it has today.
Well, so I began this career as science writer and then later assistant director of public affairs for Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. It was an unbelievable opportunity because I needed the education and the training to do the job right. And I basically got an equivalent of a kind of college degree, I guess you would say, from being at Sloan Kettering almost 4 years and being charged with writing stories for the public about advances in cancer research and cancer treatment meant that I had access to almost all of the laboratories and all of the scientists at a 4,600 person institution, oldest private and largest private cancer center in the world. So I was the, proverbial kid in the candy shop, going around from place to place, writing up these stories. And then, of course, I had the help of the people doing the research. So the chance, the chance of me making a major flub or mistake was very small to non-existent because I was mentored by the people doing the research and a very skilled crew of people, all my higher ups, all the big bosses and so forth. And so I learned an incredible amount from them. And some of them I regard as to this day as my mentors in cancer. But there was a big problem, which ultimately led to my removal from MSKCC. And that was that they had undertaken, under political pressure, to test the most controversial alternative type cancer treatment, which was called Laetrile, or scientifically amygdalin, a derivative of apricot kernels. And much to their amazement, the person who did most of the research on that, whose name was Kanematsu Sugiura, maybe the most esteemed scientist at MSKCC, came up with positive results in with Laetrile, the very last thing that they wanted to hear.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Because this was so controversial, and most of the political leaders and leaders of medicine had already got on the record that it was just pure and simple quackery, fraudulent, whatever bad name you wanted to throw at it. And here their top, most experienced scientist comes up and says, no, it isn't a cure for cancer, but it's a good palliative drug, by which he meant that it stopped the growth of the metastases to down to a level of about 10 to 20% in the treated mice versus 80% in the control animals. A huge, huge effect. I don't know that that has ever been even equaled since that time. You would think that they would be jumping for joy, and initially they were. They should have been, but instead exactly the opposite happened. And that was that they, under pressure, started to make increasingly negative statements about the outcome of the testing until they just outright started lying about it. And I was a mouthpiece for them. I actually wound up writing the official negative press release about their testing. This is very complicated because by that time I knew that there was a cover-up in the works. I was being dragged into that cover-up. I morally refused to go along with that. And I took these concerns to all the higher-ups. Personally, at dinner with Dr. Good, who was the president of Sloan Kettering, raised these issues with him and so forth. And basically, they had made their minds up to lie in order to save their own skins and to save the institution as they saw it, because they would have been cut off at the knees by some of the other forces in this field if they had gone against the consensus of the scientists that Laetrile was worthless. And then the Laetrileists, the people pushing Laetrile, were using and could continue to use Sloan Kettering's research and Sloan Kettering's name to justify their own position. So it came to a head in November of 1977. To make long story short, I stood up at a press conference that I had called and said all these things. And of course, was fired the next day, right, failing to carry out my most basic job responsibilities, which I thought was funny because I didn't know lying was, but maybe it is.
Yeah.
So that's how I started. I was shot out of the mouth of a cannon, basically, into this field. So then I was, of course, I was angry. I was upset. I had a message to give the world. It was complicated by the fact that I never said and never would say that Laetrile was a cure for cancer. I didn't believe that. I just wanted honest reckoning of Segura's work and an honest testing, which has never happened. Mm. So that's how I began. And then from there, I had to decide, consciously decide, which direction to go in. Was I going to look for another job in public relations or in science writing, or was I going to continue down the path of expanding my knowledge of these non-conventional treatments and also somewhat of the conventional treatments. And of course, I'm glad that I took that the latter path, but it wasn't easy. I had my wife was unemployed at the time. I had two kids in grade school. You know, I had rent to pay. I didn't have money in the bank. The next 3 years, I had zero income. I went back and looked at my tax statements. I had no income basically for the next 3 years. So it wasn't an easy decision, but that's the decision that I made. And I'll say, if it hadn't been for my family at that point, my wife, Martha, and my children, Melissa and Ben, and my parents, there's no way that I could have done that. I might have aspired to do it. I might have thought that would have been the right thing, but I'd be probably sitting in a cubicle somewhere, you know, typing away, doing somebody else's bidding. Instead, I've had, you know, I've been a free agent, as it were, for most of the last 50 years, able to pursue this. And I don't know of too many other people who have had that privilege and that opportunity.
Well, you certainly put it to good use. Give us a few highlights along the way of things that have been kind of peak moments between then
sure.
and now.
Well, the big thing in the whole decade of the 1990s was I got involved with an outfit you may have heard of, the U.S. government.
Yes.
So basically, I was asked, pointed to a board, a council, to advise the new Office of Alternative Medicine, which is now National Council on Complementary and Integrative Health. A big outfit now. It's like $150 million budget.
Wow.
At the time, it was a $2 million office in the National Institutes of Health. As I said, at the time, it was like if the Pope had woken up and found an office of atheism in the basement, operating in the basement of the Vatican. That's about it. And I was one of the advisors, and I was one of the hardliners. There were four of us who were considered hardliners on that committee, that 18 or 19 member committee. So that was a big responsibility and a big opportunity. And in a way, I mean, that reshaped my thinking and my understanding, because I was basically persona non grata in the cancer world. One congressman said, what do you expect? You shot them between the eyes, especially talking about my book, The
Right.
Cancer Industry, and also my book, Questioning Chemotherapy. But the 90s was a very exciting time, and it was about my involvement and struggles within the government, basically. So that was a big thing. The next big thing, another big thing, came in the 2000s, when I started to go to Europe to investigate clinics. I had gone, the first clinic I ever investigated, I was still at Sloan Kettering, and I snuck away from a meeting in California and drove down on my own with a friend and visited some of the Mexican cancer clinics, Dr. Contreras in particular. And that was an eye-opener, because I thought that these were all what they called quack cure mongers. And actually, Dr. Contreras was almost a spiritual person, very religious person, and made, from what I could see and what I heard from the patients, made no exaggerated claims for what he was offering or what he was doing. And the patients, by and large, were extremely happy with the treatment they got there. So coming from Sloan Kettering, where, you know, the horrors of chemotherapy were on full display, to this very humane, beautiful, aesthetically very pleasing place, was an eye-opener. But I didn't really get into the clinic scene or the clinic visiting mode until the 2000s. And then I was invited, when I wrote Questioning Chemotherapy, I was invited by Hans Nieper in Germany to come to Baden-Baden for the meeting of the German Oncology Society that he was co-founder of. And that was definitely a very important moment for me, because when I got to Germany, it was like alternate reality, because the culture, right. Certainly the medical culture was more like the alternative culture, you know, the health foodie culture in the United States, a very minority thing. Whereas in Germany, the majority of oncologists were either using some form of complementary medicine or were sending patients to complementary practitioners. This the spearhead of this, of course, was mistletoe. Mistletoe and hyperthermia, yeah. Both treatments that were developed or invented, if you will, in Germany. And so I was amazed and entranced, really, by this. And I was eventually made the first foreign member, certainly the first American member of the DGO, the German Society of Oncology. And I, as I mentioned before, I visited 18 times over the years, took separate trips.
Amazing.
I mentioned questioning chemotherapy. So
yeah,
part of, see, what I learned at the NIH was the importance of and the centrality of randomized controlled trials in cancer, that essentially the charge was leveled against the alternative world. Well, where are your clinical trials? Meaning, where are your randomized phase three clinical trials? And we had to admit that, with a few exceptions, we didn't really have any. And they're very expensive to run and difficult to arrange, but it was a fair charge. I couldn't deny that. So that brought to mind the question, these same people, many of these same people who were making that charge were dependent, you know, using chemotherapy. So I wanted to know what was the actual effectiveness of chemotherapy. And there was a German author, still is, scientist in Heidelberg named Ulrich Abel, who had written a very thin volume on the chemotherapy of advanced carcinomas, epithelial cancers, which I had picked up on a bookshelf off a book table in Baden-Baden at one of the cancer meetings. It was in English, and it basically demolished the argument that chemotherapy was effective for advanced, mostly stage four cancers. So I wanted to sort of update that and bring that into, expand on it and bring it into the American and English speaking world, as it were. So I started working. I think actually the book started as kind of a popularization and summarization of Abel's work, but it became a work on its own. And when that came out, I mean, what was clear from that book, and still clear today, is that for the advanced stages, stage four cancers, if you just look at, we define chemotherapy as cytotoxic treatments, basically, mm-hmm. not looking now at immunotherapy, but just at, or targeted therapies, but just looking at the chemotherapy portion, it's not very effective, to put it mildly. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't work, or it doesn't work very well. The difference between the group, the treated group and the untreated group, is really just a matter of months, sometimes weeks. So I think I demolished for all time the claim that, you know, the future of cancer treatment was in chemotherapy, or that chemotherapy was even worth doing for a great many of the people that it's done for.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
That became a big part of my work. I'm also still working on a book on radiation therapy. Robert Atkins, the famous diet doctor who's passed away, was the one who actually suggested to me that I write a companion book to questioning chemotherapy and questioning radiation therapy. And I have that book in hand, I'm basically bringing it up to date because I sort of let it sit for a long time, which is okay. But I have that in hand and a similar picture. Radiation therapy is effective at shrinking tumors and at preventing recurrences in the area that's irradiated because it's a kind of atomic bomb
or
that's dropped on that area. So nothing grows and consequently the cancer doesn't grow, but it has a very debatable and probably non-existent effect for most cancers on actual survival. It's not really even given for increasing survival. And one of the leitmotifs in all of my work is to always bring people back to actual benefit of treatment.
Right.
I mean,
so important.
Because oncologists and patients have a different set of criteria for what constitutes an effective treatment. And the oncologists very often lose sight of what it is that the patient wants, or they don't want to confront this because they've kind of set up a game where the goals are achievable. who wouldn't, right? So in oncology, most of the time now, what's considered a successful treatment is something, we're talking about more advanced cancers, is something that shrinks tumors or else increases the interval that the patient doesn't have cancer, disease-free survival, they call that, or the interval where the cancer doesn't grow, progression-free survival. These are the main things that the oncologists look at, the experimenters look at. The patient is looking at the possibility of cure, if not cure, a meaningful extension of life, and with a maintenance or improvement in quality of life. So these are surveys and logic will tell you that these are the things that matter to the patient. But very often, things like progression-free survival do not correlate with increased actual survival. So when you look at a study, and I do this automatically. I look at thousands and thousands of studies, and my eye immediately goes to OS, overall survival. What I'm interested in, disease-free survival versus, or progression-free survival versus overall survival. And most of the time, I would say, they don't go in tandem. It's easier to say that the tumor disappeared. We can't see it. It's not visible. We can't find it on our scan. So you are in a state of no evidence of disease. I'd say another highlight for me has been not my discovery at all, but the discovery of cancer stem cells. This is, to me, was a blow away finding. I'm very proud of the fact that the week that it occurred, the week that this discovery was made in 2003, 2004, I was on top of this and issued a newsletter about it.
Right.
And so this explains a lot, because most cancer cells are not that dangerous. The ones that are really dangerous are cancer stem cells, and they constitute something like 1% of the tumor. So you could see, and they're highly resistant to chemotherapy and radiation therapy. So you see how you could still have cancer, and yet for all appearances, they can't measure it. They don't find it.
Yeah.
I mean, there might be ways of measuring this now with liquid biopsies and so forth, but you're not going to visualize it. So by the conventional measures, the person is in remission, but the cancer doesn't feel like it's in remission because it maintained its cancer stem cells and now it can rebuild and maybe rebuild more dangerously than the last time. So from my point of view, all of oncology at that moment should have pivoted towards at least including a consideration of cancer stem cells into the overall picture.
Mm. I noticed that you've got, I've had a good nose around the site, and, you know, your Moss Method guides, you've got kind of basic tenets there, you know, these three things we're pointing to, and right at the top of the list, there's stem cells, along with disordered metabolism and the immune system. And, yeah, so it's interesting you're putting those three things right front and center, as these are the things to pay attention to. And clearly they're not paying attention to those in standard medicine.
Right. And there are, you know, this is because there's so much confusion and so many people pushing different treatments at patients over the internet and elsewhere. One of the databases that I subscribe to has monographs or single subject books on 1,400 different supplements. So, and most of these are at one time or another have been used in cancer. So I think that's anarchy from the point of view of the patient, and they get knocked around and whipsawed from one supposed cure to another, none of which are likely to have a major impact unless you get the right things, the right products, and the right combinations. So it's both simpler and more complicated, but you have to line everything up properly in order to expect to get a beneficial effect. And when COVID hit, and I'm, by the way, today is, as we're speaking, it's the 1 year anniversary from the time that I had COVID myself. Mm-hmm. When that happened, I felt like I needed to simplify my thinking and simplify the field, because patients at that moment, people that I talked to, were not really able to go to clinics and were not able to, you know, to access much of the world. So they needed more simple, you know, simpler guidance in what they could do at home. Not that I think cancer is entirely a self-help disease. Of course, it's not. But at that moment, you know, oncology clinics were closing, and, you know, Zoom became the only way of communicating. So it precipitated a simplification or in my mind about the cancer field. And I thought to myself, well, what is it that's really essential? What do we know after 50 years of the war on cancer? What do we really know about cancer that's actionable and central? And of course, the cancer stem cell thing immediately comes to mind. But I also know that the immune system sometimes is sufficient, even without any visible change in terms of the cancer stem cells, that the immune system sometimes on its own or with some proper stimulation is capable of curing cancer, at least putting you into a long-term remission of cancer. And I've known people who have had this happen. We know for hundreds of years there have been spontaneous remissions, or spontaneous regressions of cancer. And I think you and I talked about this the last time that I was in the UK, Robin. Mm-hmm. There are over 1,000 documented cases of spontaneous remission going back to the 14th century. So this is super important, because you can't reduce everything just at this point to cancer stem cells. They're related. The immune system and the cancer stem cell are related, but they're not identical. So that's why I came up with the second key factor of cancer that has to be addressed. And the third thing is also, you can't reduce everything to one thing or two things. So the third thing that I think is central is the metabolism of cancer. The fact that tumors will light up on a PET scan, will enhance on a PET scan. And the PET scan, the FDG PET scan, is an injection of a sugar-like compound into the patient. So why do cancers light up? I mean, the main explanation of this is that cancers are defective in their energy-generating systems. And in order to do all the nasty things that cancers try to do, they need a lot of energy. So they overconsume glucose to a great degree, and they need up to 10 times as much glucose as the normal tissue. Glucose comes mostly from the bloodstream, to the cancer. And the major reason for that is people in the Western world especially, but increasingly in Asia as well, overconsume refined carbohydrates and carbohydrates in general. It's just a general trend to eating sugar and flour and, you know, other inexpensive forms of carbohydrate to stuff your stomach so you're not hungry. And also there's sort of an addictive quality to some of these foods, the sugar containing foods. So there's a kind of a bad regulation of metabolism going on. In the States, among the adult population, the government says 48% of the American adults are diabetic or pre-diabetic.
Amazing, half. Yeah, extraordinary.
And so I think this interacts with the cancer problem in numerous ways. It isn't a simple thing. If it was just simple, all you'd need to do to get rid of your cancer would be to fast. But that fasting may be beneficial, but it isn't a solution to cancer, because cancer also has alternate ways of generating energy. It's a part of the problem. So I couldn't get any more fundamental than those three categories.
Good. Yeah. Well, that's really helpful. So look, we've not got a lot of time left. I think, you know, everybody must have gained the insight from everything you've said of how much attention you've given to this area and how much thought, both from the sort of micro to the macro aspects of cancer, but the politics at one end down to what's happening at a cellular level. And extraordinary. And your new website reflects all of that. I just want to say to everybody that some of the things that are on offer there, I've had a fairly good look around, and as you'd expect, there's a whole section there on complementary and alternative medicine treatments, and an analysis of your opinion on their uses, their effectiveness, all that kind of thing, and similarly with nutrition and supplements. Then there's this amazing service you've done of actually going out and seeing these clinics, talking to the doctors, seeing what's really happening on the ground. Again, assessing, in your opinion, which, as I say, the objectivity you like to bring to things is the most valuable thing that people with cancer can rely on, is the fact if something doesn't work, it doesn't work in your book. It's not wishful thinking. And so you've been to all these clinics and actually seen what's happening on the ground. And that's a sort of a heart, if you like, that along with some other general information of what's on offer for people with cancer who want to get to grips with, you know, their own situation. And add to that bonuses like your cancer map you brought in, which is telling people where they might be able to actually go and get help from people. I mean, finding out what you want to do is only a part of the problem. You've got to find out where you can do it. Is there somebody who can actually help you with it? So enormous amount of supportive and helpful information, and that all of that's quite apart from your world view of what's happening in cancer and things like that. So immense amount of stuff on the site for people who are either interested in the field of cancer or who have cancer and desperately need some reliable information. So I would encourage everybody to have a look. As you say, it's a membership site, yeah? So if you can, there are some things presumably are available without a membership. There's a certain amount of, maybe you just want to say what's what.
Well, yes. So there is free material at the site, which we've gone over very carefully. And some of our most important articles are in that category. So I would definitely encourage people to come. There is a fee for signing up. We ask people to, it isn't exorbitant. We ask people to sign up for a 6-month membership, and I think they will be very pleased with it. I'm confident that they will. The reports are there, updated as of this year. You can, if you join up for membership, you can see all of them or any one of them that you want. One of them, the one that pertains most to childhood leukemia, is available for people who don't sign up, so they can get a pretty good idea of the quality of these reports. And I don't know of any other source of critical, independent information slash analysis of the academic or conventional treatment of cancer by diagnosis anywhere in the world.
I would agree. Yeah, extraordinary resource. And you've got a new resource there, which is called the Help Yourself Heal video series. Do you want to just say a quick word about
yes.
that?
Yes, and that's included in the membership okay. as well. My son Ben and my daughter-in-law Liz and I did this. We created a whole course, basically, of videos of me explaining all many different aspects of cancer. And this way, it's like a consultation with me, but something that could be, you know, more general, more for more general audience, and doesn't require, you know, the kind of fees that were formerly associated with having a one-on-one consultation. But I think that between all these different things, Robin, the visitor to the site and the member person who signs up is going to have as complete and as objective an analysis of the current and past cancer scene as is available anywhere in the world. I don't know of anything else, honestly, that compares with it. And I'm not given to hyperbole. So, you know, I think it's worth a look at the very least.
Definitely. And, you know, the fee, as you say, is incredibly reasonable for what you're going to get there, because it's just massive. I mean, the resource there is yep. astonishing. So we're out of time, Ralph. That went quickly. Always great to talk to you, and really so pleased to see your legacy being carried forward in this way. And if you've got one quick word to tell us what you got in the pipeline, I'd love to hear.
We're working on a printed or certainly PDF version of the entire Moss reports, meaning that in one book there will be an analysis of every kind of cancer, maybe down to about 95% of all cases. We expect this to be very popular with practitioners, maybe not so much with the standard oncologists, but there are so many other people now who are interacting with cancer patients on a professional level.
Yes.
The chiropractors, the naturopaths, the homeopaths, the physical therapists, and so forth. And they are justifiably curious about these treatments that their patients are getting from the oncologist, and they want to be able to advise them and to be able to say, well, that one is very effective, and that other one, really, they haven't shown that it extends life. And I think this could be enormously beneficial. It'll all be in one place.
Right, and it's a reference.
Yes. And another thing that I'm doing is finishing up. Well, of course, I'm working on continuously updating these reports, but also in the articles that are on the website, as I go through them and edit them, I'm also putting in 2022 or next year, you know, perspective on them as much as I feel the need to. So you're not just reading, oh, this is what happened in 2003, but you're reading what 20 years later, how this looks, oh, this didn't pan out, or this became, you know, the hottest thing in oncology.
Very important. Okay, fantastic, Ralph. Thank you very much indeed for coming on today.
Pleasure.
Bye-bye. I'm delighted to be able to offer all of you a discount to accessing the full breadth of the content of the Moss Report website. A reminder of the address, that's themossreport.com. You can get 10% off by using the coupon code YES10, so that's YES number 10 when purchasing. Thanks very much for listening today. If you're a regular listener and you'd like to have your say as to what you like, what you'd like to hear more of, what you'd like to hear less of, anything you'd like to share about the show, please email radio@yestolife.org.uk with your thoughts. Hope you'll be able to listen again next week, when I'll be back with another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.